Holidays bring feasting, fluffy dinner rolls, tasty stuffing, and your family's French toast bakes. With Hero Bread, indulge in your holiday favorites, made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, bagels, croissants, buttermilk biscuits, and more. And don't forget their Hero Hawaiian rolls. With 4 grams of protein and 0 grams net carbs, Hero Bread has you covered with 0 to 5 grams net carb and high fiber options, so your holidays stay delicious and balanced. Like their 3 grams net carb pan au chocolat. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at hero.co. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains up to 17 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Ratings go down the toilet if I'm not here.
All I do is simply put the math in my favor.
We agree that Brandon and John do good work.
The reason is simple wrestling economics.
Then told the Netflix numbers. I've been told the metrics a little bit, probably 5 different times. I still don't get it.
There were respectable wrestling journalists who needed answers.
Thank you very much, members of the media. I hope you all go to hell.
How about we pop a number right here, right now?
The whole part of the show, man.
And here we go. It is John Pollock and Brandon Thurston. We are just diving right into things. How are you, Brandon?
I'm good. I made it.
This was a race against time for you?
Yes.
Life happens. Yes. Well, we, much like Brandon's day to day, we have been hit with the whirlwind news, that TNA has a new home. We're going to be talking about all the makings of Hiroshi Tanahashi's retirement match. And yes, Paul Levesque may hear all the Netflix numbers. He doesn't know what they mean. We'll try and make sense of them from the past list, because Raw, despite Mark Shapiro's touting of such,
number one
show in globally every single week.
Well, stranger things happened. That's what happened.
It was, yes. I guess the Vecna ruined WWE's streak over that.
I've never seen Stranger Things, but I've heard of it.
It's an interesting show, to say the least. Well, here we go, everybody. We have the announcement that everyone has been waiting for, and that is TNA landing on AMC, the home of Breaking Bad, the home of Mad Men. Now they are bringing TNA wrestling to their screens beginning January the 15th, a press release going out Tuesday. AMC Networks and TNA Wrestling announced a multi-year agreement to bring TNA's flagship weekly television show Thursday Night Impact to AMC, TNA's new television home in the U.S. The TNA-AMC partnership kicks off live from the Curtis Culwell Center in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Thursday, January 15th, 2026. Thursday Night Impact, a 2-hour block of action-packed TNA wrestling exclusively on television every Thursday from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. The new TNA-AMC agreement also includes extending the weekly telecast to viewers on AMC+. Which would technically not make it exclusively on television every Thursday from Thursday to 9, but we digress. So that is our the main takeaway here. They have landed this deal, a multi-year agreement. At this point, we do not have the confirmed length or financials of the deals, which are obviously very key components here. But regardless, in a nutshell, Brandon, what does this mean for TNA?
For AEW. What does it mean for AEW?
That's its own separate show that we're going to be doing. What about AEW here? But first, TNA, and comparing this to their home of the last 5 years, which has been Access TV, which many people have not had access to.
Yes. So Access TV is a relatively low-profile cable network. How many U.S. homes are there in this entire country? About 130 million or so. How many of those homes have cable? About half of them. How many cable homes had access? About half of those. So maybe 1/4 of the country could watch TNA if they wanted to on Thursday nights. AMC is in almost all the cable homes, according to their disclosures from December of last year, or as of December of last year, they were in 60 million homes, which is which is probably a few million under what the top, the very top, most highly carried cable networks were at that point. ESPN, in its most recent quarterly report, think of ESPN as one of the most widely carried cable networks, had 61 million. So AMC's probably got a little bit less than 60 million at this point. This is going to be a much better platform for TNA. More people will be able to watch it if they want to.
Yeah, Impact. We have not gotten ratings for Impact for basically the last 2 years. And towards the trail end, that last year where they were being reported on Access, I mean, they were doing, for a period, they were doing like in the neighborhood of 100,000 viewers. They were falling below that by the end of 2023. So it's really hard to even make a comparison with whatever their new audience is on AMC because, you know, we just don't have numbers for these last 2 years of like how much had it fallen and was there a rebound this past year? Because, you know, other metrics for TNA would suggest that, this was a much more popular product over this past 18 months, than prior. But that is one of many question marks.
The latest numbers that we have for Impact on Access TV is we have it going in some weeks under 100,000 viewers. So, and that's in 2023. So what's it been doing in 2024? Don't know. What's it doing in 2025? Is there an increase, as you mentioned, because of the NXT interaction? Maybe, but who knows? I'm under the impression that Access TV just has not been a Nielsen client in the last year or so, or a couple of years. So they're not maybe even being measured. In any case, we don't know what their ratings are. We should get the AMC ratings. AMC is measured by Nielsen. So I expect that we will be getting these ratings. Somebody asked me, on Patreon, what's your prediction for how many viewers this is doing and is going to do? And I said, well, I know one thing for sure. The debut on, what is it, January 15th? Live from the Curtis Caldwell Center in Garland, Texas, just outside of Dallas, going to be the most watched episode in the history of TNA on AMC, I bet. So let's say it was doing like 100,000 on Access TV this year. It will have about double the reach. Don't think that's going to mean double the viewership, but you know, I mean, it's maybe somewhere in the 200 range. It could still be under 200. I don't know. The thing is, so Programming Insider presumably will continue to report ratings. And if it's highly enough rated, I certainly will get it. But I wonder if it'll be highly enough rated for Programming Insider to pick it up because these top lists, these ratings reports that we do get tend to be limited to like the top, I don't know, 100 or something like that. So it's going to have to be in there maybe for us to get it. But I would think, you know, what's the debut to do? Maybe 800 or something like that? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that the first episode, as we have seen with all of these deals, tends to be the one that gets the most promotional push. And you would hope that they do a like satisfactory number for the first week. The question is like, what is like the leveling off, audience? But most importantly is just how lucrative this deal is for TNA. I think that's the biggest question that I would have. Regarding this deal. And, you know, you're going from a network in Access that Anthem owns, which comes with its own questions of unloading its biggest property, but going to a network now where you are now getting, you know, what you would assume to be at least a substantial rights fee. Certainly this would appear to be the most lucrative deal for the company since the Spike TV days. And if
it's
this
like, it doesn't matter if they get a rights fee or not, right? Because there's such a value in doubling their reach for them. So it leads me to think that the compensation for this is rather on the low end, and maybe it helps or does completely cover the production cost. I know there's a number out there being rumored of 30 million, maybe over the lifetime of the deal. And then we also don't know what the length of this deal is other than this press release saying multi-year. If this is a 5-year deal, I mean, it's 5 divided by 30 could be 6 million a year. Seems believable to me. What's going to cost them to produce TV? Say maybe it's like, let's say half a million an episode or something like that. That comes out to what, 25, it'd be like $25 million per year to produce. So that'll be a loss on if you're only getting that much. But regardless, you know, this is better than probably essentially zero that they were getting from Beyond Access TV while doubling their reach.
Well, I mean, if we just work with that, there's also going to be, like, I would think there is going to be some upgrade or at least added expenses here. The first week is going to be a live episode. Then they're doing another live episode the second week. And while I don't think this is going to be live weekly, I would certainly think they're going to be doing more live impacts than past years. And that will come with, you know, those added expenses as well that is attached to this. And I do welcome, anyone in an official capacity at Impact. They can come and, give us the straight financials on this deal. And then we can go, through it. But I would think you have like a pretty good guesstimate, that we can, work with here. It will also be simulcast on AMC Plus, which, I'm going to guess
you
don't.
Is it going to be live simulcast or is it just going to be on demand?
I'm fairly certain that they were, what does this press release say exactly here? It also includes extending the weekly telecast to viewers on AMC Plus. So that may be a case of it going up afterwards.
We should ask AMC to clarify that.
Well, yeah, they did give a statement to the Wrestling Observer that TNA fans will be able to continue to watch Thursday Night Impact on TNA Plus as well as AMC. TNA Plus will also continue to be the home of TNA's premium live events and the full history of TNA. So it doesn't seem like if you are a TNA Plus subscriber that you're going to be losing any of the perks that you currently get with your subscription, and they're going to continue to do some of these specials throughout the year.
TNA wrestling exclusively on television. So it's television, not streaming on TNA Plus. So there'll be a couple ways to watch this at least.
So there will be... The show will make its way onto AMC Plus. That's what we can say confidently here. There was also a question asked of what does this mean for the TNA relationship with NXT? Is this going to end the NXT relationship? Well, Carlos Silva was on Busted Open Radio on Tuesday, and this is his response.
Is this relationship with NXT going to continue?
Absolutely. It's a big part of helping us get this deal. It's a big part of now being able to almost give back a little and provide a big platform for some of those superstars as well. And so absolutely the storylines, the things we're doing together, they're just going to continue to grow into 2026. I mean, like you said, Dave, the last 5-6 months have been awesome. And I think there's more to come, and 2026 is just going to build off of that and be even bigger.
So from Carlos Silva's standpoint, all systems go with the NXT relationship into 2026. Silva was also interviewed by The Takedown on Sports Illustrated and was asked if WWE had helped negotiate this deal. And Silva's response was, no, we did all the negotiations ourselves, with me leading the charge on the TNA side and then CAA leading the charge as our representative and our partner on the deal. And SI goes on to state that he would not confirm the terms of the agreement between TNA and AMC, but noted that both parties were satisfied. When asking Silva directly if he believes WWE will exercise any clause akin to what has been reported, that being that there would be a clause in the deal that could trigger an end date.
A 60-day notice
of the relationship ending. He said, it's all going to continue. There's a lot of things in the works. Working with the top levels with both Nick Khan and Paul Levesque, and then working with NXT and so many others. Everyone's been great. So no, I have zero buzz or inkling around anything other than it being going great. And we're going to continue to keep the partnerships going strong. Silva ended.
So the notion here is that it would be a threat to WWE, or WWE would see TNA as more of a competitor if they're on a better TV network, I suppose. There's still a distant number three, I would say. There's still a quite distant competitor, even though this is good news for them. And I would say they're rather distant from AEW still.
Well, how would you break that down? I mean, I hear all the time, this is
viewership for one thing.
If
TNA Impact on Thursday nights, granted at 9 to 11, not 8 to 10, starts to do, you know, within 100,000 viewers, 50,000 viewers of what Dynamite is delivering, that then there's a conversation to be had.
Like, if we go through the chart, and correct me, these are all off the top of my head. SmackDown, we believe average annual value of 290 million.
I'm sorry, 287 million. But I think since your favorite Third Hour became part of that deal, I think it might be a little more than that.
Then below that, this just being what is on television, we're excluding Raw. NXT, 20 million.
25.
25 million on CW. This deal, like, we don't know. Like, let's just throw out a figure of, you know, 6 to 10 million, okay? Like, we'll just ballpark it. In comparison, like, AEW is at 185 million per year. And I think these are kind of important to look at sort of the tiers of wrestling programming that are going to be in place for the coming years until these all come due. And I would say another part to all of this is that throughout these negotiations, Carlos Silva had initially pegged a ballpark figure of hoping to get between 7 and 10 million per year, which maybe this ultimately falls in that that range. But then out of nowhere comes this introduction of Big Data plus Panel. And I would be really curious to ask if, like, was that at all a bit of a stumbling block when you are selling your wrestling programming and all of a sudden, you're looking for millions of dollars and there's this big neon sign that is pointing towards pro wrestling as being, on the wrong side of this new methodology that's out there. Like, this is the first deal we have that has kind of come through this new methodology, and we're not going to know the full impact until, like, years from now when all of these other programs come due, because there's not going to be any wrestling programming that's coming up for renewal anytime soon.
Yeah. And as we've discussed here, it seems quite possible that the Big Data Plus Panel discrepancy is due to, I guess, I suspect it's due to the way that wrestling is categorized, not as sports, and it's not being allowed some exception that sports are being allowed when it comes to long-term viewership, even though these programs are 2 hours long. I guess if you're a network and, you know, TNA wants to be on a better network because they're on a network that's only in half the cable homes, why would you pay them anything when if I'm AMC and I've got double the reach, why would I offer you, you know, 6 million or 10 million when what you need to begin with is reach into at least most of the cable homes, which you don't have. Unless there's multiple bidders. Now, there might have been CW involved, and just like selling a house, if you have multiple bidders, that can run up the price and run up the options that you have if you're a content seller or a house seller. If you're selling your house content on the market, that might have brought the price up. But that was, I mean, we didn't have any hard reporting, did we, about CW? We certainly had some reporting here in Sports Illustrated, the takedown from John Alba in anticipation of this deal being announced about AMC.
Super chat here. Congrats to TNA for their AMC deal. TK should have gotten that deal for ROH when he had the chance. Does he want ROH off the ground or not? Hesitation is the enemy of progress. Remember this lesson.
Now, the notion is that Ring of Honor could have signed with who? A TV deal with who?
Yeah, there's no indication that AMC would have necessarily been interested in ROH. What we do know,
TV maybe CW. Tony Khan himself has admitted to having discussions with CW before NXT was there.
Yes. And I mean, ultimately it comes down to, like, what is the, like, I think Tony Khan believes that he is not going to sign a deal for ROH that is just to get it on television, where he believes it's undervaluing what could be something lucrative for them. Now, you could argue this many years into owning ROH, is that elusive deal going to come across your desk? And that becomes a question. Like, if the answer is no, then what is the purpose of ROH beyond your subs on Honor Club and adding more tapings, having more people under contract? Like, there are inherent value to having ROH running, but if your whole hope is landing this television deal, like, is that going to be coming your way? And in theory, like, another network got involved here and they have put their money towards a product in TNA.
I guess the presumption of the premise seems to be that if Ring of Honor were airing on CW or True TV, and we have no indication that they were ever in discussions with AMC, but if Ring of Honor were on traditional TV of some sort, would it have been harder for TNA to get this deal? I doubt it.
I think his argument here is that, yeah, like I think like this is the idea that here is AMC. They're spending several million a year on pro wrestling. Why was it not ROH that was able to get a several million dollar a year deal? And frankly, would Tony Khan like sign this deal? Like if the identical deal comes across for him for Ring of Honor as TNA, is that what Tony Khan is looking for? Like, I don't know. I can't get into Tony Khan's head about what his strategy is with Ring of Honor. Like, we are coming up on 4 years since he bought this company.
Yeah. We've discussed the idea of like, look at how great it was when they put their pay-per-view on YouTube. Then maybe they should just put everything on YouTube so that at least people can watch it, or at least people will watch it. Obviously, you can watch if you subscribe to Honor Club, but I have to think the subs for that are pretty low at this point.
Yes. And I mean, they have made that shift. It's they're no longer pay-per-views. They come with your subscription to Honor Club. So, I mean, if you're subscribing to Honor Club, like you get three of their big shows each year, but it's one where, you know, if the idea of landing this television deal, I mean, maybe it's just the idea of not wanting to sign a bad deal and be committed to it. But what are you holding on to, waiting for, if this is going to be a venture that lands you into profitability that you would not suspect ROH on its own is anywhere close to?
Yeah. At the moment, it's mainly developmental.
Yeah. And again, like there's a value to having that kind of a system. If you're Tony Khan, like is this thing could be a loss leader for you, but it's our closest replication of developmental where people are getting experience. It is a place where you can work when you hear so many talent that there's just no spots for them on Collision or Dynamite, that at least it's an outpost that you can develop some talent and then they can graduate to AEW. Like there's a purpose to having that.
Is there any negative values at watering down the AEW brand at all?
I don't think it waters it down. I don't think ROH is anywhere close to a priority for most people. Most people's consumption of ROH is limited to those three shows they do a year. And I think it's a very niche audience that is following this on a weekly basis. Is it harming AEW? I mean, you could argue that Collision waters down Dynamite. You could say that, but you're balancing this with more content, more revenue. And yeah, there is going to be like, is there a demand for 4 hours of AEW programming every week versus two? Maybe for some, but I'm sure for others, like that's too much. When I think overall, like the amount of wrestling out there, it is forcing people to just become very brand specific, and you're only going to be following one brand. And for many people, that's going to be WWE. I think it's tougher than ever to get people to sample new or more wrestling when you're already consuming multiple hours per week of one company itself.
And what we've discussed this as this relationship has gone on, like what is the value that WWE gets out of having this relationship between NXT and TNA? Is WWE happy, genuinely happy that TNA is on a more widely carried network now?
I think ultimately, like whatever you think your end goal is going to be here for WWE, I could not have envisioned this being where this relationship would have gone when it was first started. Like this runs so counter to previous relationships WWE would ever have with companies where they were the clear, dominant player in that relationship. And in this one, like TNA has greatly benefited from it. Like if this deal ended tomorrow, TNA is like on pretty solid footing. At least it's most solid footing since losing Spike TV. Like, it would be a blow to lose WWE, but I don't think it would be fatal to them by any stretch.
Should TNA invoke the 60-day notice?
I mean, like for TNA, it's like, what have you like in this last year? Okay. Jordan Grace has moved on. Joe Hendry has moved on. That's not like handicapped this company. I think there's an argument for every company that one of the great benefits of the territory system was that when a character had run its course, it was time to move on. It freshens up the territory. It gets new blood in there. I think there's like a healthy turnover that a lot of companies do not experience. Like, we see people develop on WWE, develop on AEW, and they are set in these roles for years and years and years. And for TNA, it's like they are probably going to be in a constant, you know, just reshuffling, because talents are going to move on. And I don't think that's the worst thing in the world for them. But now they've landed their television deal. They've had these great attendance markers, even when you go by the public records. Still great attendance for Slammiversary, for Bound for Glory. You know, it is quite the story here of where TNA has turned itself around over these last 24 months.
Or is the biggest purpose of to WWE of the relationship with TNA to mitigate AEW to, I guess, if you could look at this deal, if you're WWE, and say, all right, they got on to a major TV network, and that's, this deal is going to be whatever it is, multiple years, 3, maybe 5 years. And when AEW's contract comes up for renewal, there'll be another wrestling property, far less highly paid in terms of a rights fee. And maybe that, you know, it's increasing the supply of content, of wrestling content onto the air. It makes AEW a little less scarce and special. And then maybe it helps bring the cost of AEW content down.
I mean, that's a theory. I think it's a really tough one. Like, again, like, we're talking, like, whatever TNA is making on this deal, it is a tiny percentage of what AEW is making. And I think if you were to bet futures today, in 5 years, is AEW going to be able to get a strong renewal? I feel fairly confident. You can't guarantee that.
If I'm WWE and I say, all right, I really want to help TNA now and build up this viewership and get it as close as possible, ideally exceed Dynamite, so that Dynamite's viewership doesn't look that great.
I mean, we'll see.
They're already doing under 500,000 viewers at this point.
Listen, if there's a result where WWE is ultimately able to buy TNA, yes, you can argue that. But, like, what is the benefit of, like, propping up one company against another company that you technically do not have a stake in either one?
Yeah, I mean, they've done a lot to counter-program AEW and do things that seem like, you know, do nothing, but they're meant to be sort of a competitive attack against AEW. I'm not sure what the benefit is to WWE.
Well, we will probably revisit this this big story involving the AMC. Will you be tuning in on January 15th, Brandon? When was the last time you sat down and watched any TNA programming? Weeks, months, years?
Probably would be years. When's the last time I watched any wrestling programming? I did turn on Survivor Series, and I alerted you of that.
Yes.
I did turn on some Survivor Series brought to you by Riyadh Season. Things happen. So I did watch some of that. The last time I watched AMC was probably watching an old movie of some sort, maybe in the 2000s decade or so.
Okay. Well, there we have it. I'm glad that you stumbled upon Survivor Series and I got that live update. But now we are going to shift gears. Maybe another show that Brandon might be watching will be Wrestle Kingdom, coming up on January the 4th at the Tokyo Dome. And returning to the show, the great Trish Spears, who has written this excellent breakdown of all the machinations behind Hiroshi Tanahashi's retirement match. Trish, welcome back to the show. And
hello.
Do you have any intrigue in seeing TNA moving to AMC? Any thoughts about this landmark deal for the company?
I think we're still at a point where we don't know enough of the details to kind of comprehend exactly what it's going to mean, especially if it's something that they're not going live 52 weeks a year. You know, how is it going to impact in terms of talent pay and benefits? And then, yeah, I kind of see Brandon's point around the impact of lowering the potential value of AEW's next TV deal. So that is something that I'm thinking of as well as being another potential platform that's kind of off limits to them when it comes to their next set of negotiations.
Well, we have Trish on to talk about this great piece called The Final Road that you can go and read on the Social Suplex. We will include a link in the show description. Trish, how long were you working on this story? Because this looks like this, it was months in the making, and you know, trying to unpack like Japanese wrestling politics can be very, very complicated. And I thought you kind of did as a really clear job of trying to represent like all sides of what had to be like a really fascinating series of negotiations, and how just the left and the right hand somehow had to be in sync here to create this match on January 4th.
It's kind of a strange thing, because sometimes when you first hear things, I think you'll know this yourself, you don't always think about the importance of them. So you just kind of put them away in your memory bank. And really, you know, there's been information for this story for kind of 2 years, but when it kind of really started was back at the previous Tokyo Dome, back in January this year, stood out of a very, very wet and cold Otta gymnasium. And that's when we first heard about Nakamura being, you know, the potential opponent for Tanahashi. And then really it's kind of snowballed from there. And once we got to the announcement at Anjo, I just thought, well, I need to write this, because, and then I read a lot of other kind of summaries and I thought, I don't know if we've really told the story. I think I can kind of add some value to it. And that kind of went from there, really. And then we were very lucky. I mean, there was parts of the story that I wanted the kind of a viewpoint from Okada's side. And I thought, can I get that? And it turned out I could. And same with some of the other bits around Nakamura as well. So, yeah, we've been very lucky with the people that have worked with us to produce this. But it's essentially, you know, 2 years of working, contacting to build it. And then, yeah, 4 weeks to put it together, essentially.
So in looking at, you know, you kind of go through like the different periods that these negotiations went through. Why don't you just bring people up to speed on Shinsuke Nakamura and sort of the when things heated up the most over these last couple of months of how close they got to? Because I think for most of the public, I think they really took it as a potential landing spot for this retirement match when you got like the shout out by Nakamura when WWE was over there in October, Tanahashi acknowledging this. And as you point out here in the article, like it was sort of like teasing this to the public. And then it was ultimately the match was going to be settled on Okada several weeks later.
Yeah, so the events around the WWE show at Ryogoku Sumo Hall were really the kind of like the touch paper in terms of everyone kind of feeling like it was going towards Nakamura. So Nakamura had been spoken about since January in New Japan. And then things have kind of gone quiet over the summer. There was more talk around Naito. And then once we got to Ryogoku, you know, and Nakamura's using Tanahashi's phrases, and Tokyo Sports are straight on this, and Tanahashi's playing back to it, because Tanahashi is, I said this in the article, but he's not Tetsuya Naito. He doesn't kind of play games. He doesn't try and tease things that he's not going to deliver on. So that's why kind of a lot of people who follow what Tanahashi does closely in Japan were very kind of sparked up by this. And then, yeah, he went through Tokyo Sports. Nakamura was still teasing it and saying, you know, we'll see what happens. And then Tanahashi was like, I'll use Nakamura as my influence for the match in Gifu with Yota Tsuji when he was challenging for the IWGP global title on November 2nd. And then he does the landslide driver in that match as well. So in terms of the public kind of match building, it would make you feel like all things were going towards Nakamura at that point.
And you mentioned in the article that W denied to Fightful that the match had even been broached, to use that word. Mm-hmm. But you write that, I gather you say it feels extremely unlikely that this was the case. And why do you think that?
So I know that other people have been given or shown, would probably be the more accurate thing, contact between the two companies. So that comes from a pretty credible source. I actually had a second person come to us since we wrote to indicate the same as well, and to show us things that make that pretty much certain.
WWE is just using a very flexible definition of the word broached.
Sure, and I think that's part of it, isn't it? Because to be honest, the biggest surprise for me has been the lack of dispute over things like this, because when you have something like this and, you know, it's multiple different companies having different viewpoints on the same story, I expected more kind of pushback. And as yet, we haven't kind of seen that. why WWE wouldn't deny it, I'm not 100% sure. I guess you can look at it and think, well, ultimately, they didn't get the match up, so why would you want to admit that you didn't kind of succeed? Is there an element to that? Have they done what they wanted to do in terms of, you know, making the relationship between AEW and New Japan more difficult at points this year? I don't know. But yeah, I thought that was quite interesting that we didn't get any pushback in that sense.
Did you ask WWE about that specifically preparing this?
No, I tried to contact and didn't get a response from WWE.
Same.
So they are the one party in this where we aren't really sourcing from WWE. So they were sourcing from New Japan, from AEW, and around kind of Okada and Nakamura and Tanahashi, but there isn't from WWE, just because we just couldn't get any, to be quite honest with you. You couldn't get any response. So.
I would think that they don't want to be seen as, you know, the party that didn't make happen what they might have wanted to make happen. You know, they're the biggest game in town by far, and they never want to appear as anything but.
Yeah, I think they missed an opportunity here. You know, I think they had a real opportunity to build a relationship with New Japan in terms of their spheres of influence and, you know, basically kind of disrupt the other side of the kind of working relationships between New Japan and AEW. And it's not the first time they've kind of done that. And I know some of that goes with the mentality of, you know, we are the big dogs. We are the one place in town. But when you're kind of having a global Cold War, essentially, sometimes you need to build relationships in ways that you wouldn't normally do so. And I think they had the opportunity here to do that and they squandered it. So from their perspective, I'm not sure that this would be a good publicity story.
Had they been able to secure Nakamura for this show, what's your best guess as to what the ripple effect would have been with Nakamura in this position? And given the relationship with AEW, given the fact that Takeshita is in a featured match on this show, I mean, was it completely untenable that all parties could have been satisfied with this?
I guess that's a question for potentially AEW to answer. But in terms of, you know, the worst case scenario, and we've heard, you know, that there were kind of, during some parts of negotiations, there were kind of things laid out. You know, it could be highly possible that being that one of the big issues, as Brian Alvarez pointed out yesterday on Wrestling Observer Radio, was Takeshi being placed underneath mm-hmm. of Nakamura, then is it possible that Takeshi could have dropped to Goto in Gifu? Possibly. That's the worst case, and actually nuclear scenario. But it definitely would have changed the relationship, and all the kind of wording that we got in terms of the talks between AEW and New Japan was making New Japan well aware that, you know, there would be consequences, ramifications, whatever word you want to use. And it would, you know, I think it's naive to think that it wouldn't. If you are working with someone else's basic like enemy or someone that's really working to damage their brand, their product, then if you are going to work with that, then the people that have been damaged the most aren't going to be happy about it, and they are going to feel like there will be a change in that relationship. I think that's kind of standard practice, and it's hard because I think everything's very black and white, very tribalistic in terms of how we talk about some of these companies sometimes. So it's very easy to kind of want to say, you know, it's all about this or it's all about that, and they shouldn't act like that. But everybody here is looking out for their business, you know, having to deal with their own challenges, and that's where you get the friction points where these things meet.
Sorry, John. Go ahead.
No, you go, Brian.
Do you think, Trish, the relationship for New Japan, is the relationship with AEW continuing to benefit them? They are now the smaller player in an interpromotional relationship, and usually the smaller player is the one who's maybe benefiting less than the other, at least.
I think there's still, you know, quite significant benefits. The fact that Takeshita is there this year and being such a significant part of their gear is a huge benefit in itself, that he's been allowed to be dual contracted. I don't think that him being a dual contracted wrestler is the point of the issues that he's had in terms of his presentation in New Japan this year. But also, you know, it does offer a lot of New Japan wrestlers the chance to add to their income, especially while the yen is so devalued at the current time and inflation is such a big thing. And, you know, there's been lots of stories in the last few months around kind of the pay issues and contract issues in New Japan. So that is a huge benefit. And then, see, when they have what we believe is revenue share for the Forbidden Door show as well. So there is benefits to them. And I think having that kind of, not just the connection with AEW for New Japan, but also having that kind of tri connection with CMLL as well, it's beneficial to everyone. And you do sort of have access to the people that have left New Japan previously as well. So there are benefits to them. I think one of the big questions going forward around this was how valuable is that relationship in terms of, you know, you're losing the strong shows. So the next New Japan show in the US is under the New Japan banner, A New Beginning, rather than the New Japan Strong banner, which was supported quite heavily by AEW. So is that a thing? Are they going to become more isolationist and focus more on their Japanese business rather than kind of the international kind of expansion that we saw 2015 onwards? I think that's probably a bigger question. It might be more around kind of their strategy going forward than thinking primarily about their relationship with AEW.
When you look at January 4th, like, I don't think it's exaggerating to say, like, this is one of the most important shows for New Japan. When you have got the wrestling world's interest for that night and maybe trickling over to New Year Dash the next night, but you have Tanahashi and Okada that will not be there after Wrestle Kingdom. And this is such an important show of bringing, like, it's this one night huge event that they're going to stage. And kind of an audition to the audience of, like, what is the next chapter of New Japan? And you've got to balance all of this out, that people are coming in for the farewell to Tanahashi, but also giving them a reason to come back. And certainly this card is kind of made up of that, with Yota Tsuji going for the championship, with Aaron Wolf on this show. But to me, like, it's one of New Japan's most important shows of this generation, I would argue.
I think that for me, the undercard matches, so Yota Tsuji, yep, he has to be crowned and they have to get that right. And Aaron Wolf, with him coming in, you know, the way that he's come in, it always reminds me of how Ronda Rousey came into WWE, especially in terms of the impact that she had on the Fox deal and the way that he's been able to get them a primetime slot for this Wrestle Kingdom broadcast. So they have to get those things right, probably even more so than anything to do with Tanahashi that night. And yeah, because they need to that stability. You know, this year has been hugely unstable, especially once they lost Tetsuya Naito back in the spring. So you have to do that. It is now time to get the wheels turning. It's probably beyond time to get the wheels turning on pushing new people at the top. So at least you can look at it as that power vacuum at the top is maybe perhaps useful in terms of pushing new people in those spots and making them the recognized people in New Japan. And that's where having this primetime slot, having all this attention, having, you know, what could be and what people in New Japan are talking about, up to 50,000 people potentially in the Tokyo Dome, is so important that you get that execution right. So it's not just the Tanahashi retirement show, but it's something that sets them up well into, you know, the start, middle of next year. And yeah, the Tsuji win and how they execute that, and then the Aaron Wolf debut, maybe even more so, are for me, yeah, the most important things on that show. They have to get that right. Otherwise, you know, it gets difficult, because they are a live event business. They are not a business built on TV revenue or any of the things that most of the American companies are built upon. So that's something where the execution here is of massive importance.
One of the more scandalous things I learned from your article, Tony Khan, not a fan of Evil. Not looking forward to this Aaron Wolf versus Evil match, I take it.
Well, that was a Fightful report that came out during the G1 finals weekend. And it was very much after there'd been kind of a lot of pushback as to why is Evil Takeshita's opponent in the finals. And that came out through Fightful. And it very much said, you know, basically it was abscond, AEW have no part in this booking, and then led with, yeah, this is a reason Evil isn't booked by AEW or any of these crossover shows. And that was an interesting point that wasn't well received on the other side of the Pacific, because, you know, Evil has someone that is very much connected with Hiroshi Tanahashi. And, you know, he faced him at the Dome this year, and it actually was a pretty good match. Like, I was in the Dome, I will tell you, it was very well received. So being his closeness and the fact that he's being trusted with Aaron Wolf, and I know the gimmicks will help to protect Wolf in that way, it's felt like very much a shot. And, you know, it's that decision is difficult. I think if they presented Takeshita differently, maybe that match would have gone differently. Maybe the atmosphere would be different. Maybe the talking points would be different. But that's more about how New Japan presented Takeshita than in terms of that tournament, in terms of rather than picking Evil for the final, when what they were really doing was kind of trying to recreate. They put Evil in Jay White's spot in from 2019. That's what they were doing. So the idea is you get Takeshita, in the final, he wins, and then you get Yota Tsuji out in the semifinals, so in order for him to be the double dash kind of challenger. But yeah, it's I can see why so many people hated it. I think House of Torture are very much long in the tooth for anybody that watches New Japan on a regular basis. But I think it's definitely something to consider, Tanahashi's relationship with Evil, when you are making statements like that.
You also wrote that perhaps the only man who knows the entire story of the past year is Hiroshi Tanahashi. And I would argue that of him, of Tony Khan, of Paul Levesque, he is clearly the most likely of those three to at some point do some like extra long interview and go through this at some point in time. Would he be the individual that you would most like love to just inject with truth serum and answer all your unanswered questions?
See, I'm not sure if I agree that he would be the most likely to ever talk about it, just because he is the ultimate company guy. You know, and although you kind of argue, I can kind of argue myself, because his appearance on NHK radio, and I had a native Japanese speaker go through that one with me, he was quite revealing. So maybe he would do, but he, at the end of the day, you know, he's selfless in a way that he will always put that company first. And if it means not talking about something or it means dressing something up, he's never going to be that person that does the kind of like, this is exactly what happened and I'm going to burn all the relationships that we have with anybody else. But yeah, he's, and that's, I guess, one of the questions is when people say, you know, when you look at where he started and the way he talked about Nakamura last year and about coming full circle, because it would be 20 years from his first match at the Tokyo Dome against Nakamura for the under 30 championship in 2005. I guess that's where people say, if that's what he wanted, like this guy's been so selfless across the course of his career, you know, why can't we give him what he wants? But he understands the politics of it. He understands the way that wrestling works, and he's just going to put his company first and make sure that this is the biggest night possible. This was the last of his kind of, his 10 things that he wanted when he became president. And a lot of them were kayfabe, but one of them was to put 40,000 people in the Tokyo Dome. And we all kind of went, how are they going to do that? But he's already surpassed that. So that, yeah, this is his final big achievement as a wrestler. And I think he deserves it. And the other thing around this year is I don't think we've kind of acknowledged, I wish I wrote more about this, how hard he's worked this year. He's had more singles matches than any year since 2006. There's been times where people were worried about, you know, his body, would he hold up during the G1? Would they have to shut him down before the Tokyo Dome to ensure that he'd get there? But yeah, he's given everything he can this year. And I think that should definitely be recognized more than what we do.
My last question is kind of the odd man out of this whole thing to me is Tetsuya Naito and what you see as sort of just his future period. And if New Japan comes into that equation at all with Naito, is his presence like missed in New Japan? Like certainly this is a super popular character and yet he's had pretty much a nondescript 2025.
Yeah. It's such a strange one, isn't it? Because I don't think anyone at the start of 2025 thought that Tetsuya Naito would be out of the company. I don't think I definitely did. You know, everyone, it's kind of well known that that's been my favorite wrestler to follow for the last decade and also. But it's a case of there's been some confusion about it. People have, you know, they look back at the summer and thought the office isn't really worried about this. So is there something else going on? Is this a break for him to have surgery, you know, on his eyes again? That's definitely something. And, you know, look at his knees and everything else, and then be able to establish kind of a secondary brand with the Los Tricolores brand that he's got with Bushi. And then, yeah, he's just sheer lack of activity. You know, he's just basically plying his trade at Revolution Pro here in the UK and in WXW in Germany so far. And both of them being affiliated with New Japan has raised some eyebrows. But it's an interesting one. I think there's a big money match left for him with Yota Tsuji. I think they've kind of set that up. They could have done that before he left. They didn't. There's still not really done very much with his former group. I know they've kind of put them with the War Dogs, but that feels more like a temporary solution than anything. So there is the opportunity for him to come back in. And they do feel the miss. I guess their idea is now is that we've taken that pain. You know, we took that pain during this year's G1. We've taken that pain kind of in the autumn as well. And we're not feeling it right now because you're on the World Tag League is essentially Tanahashi's final road tour. And that's kind of ensuring that this will be a really successful tour for them, probably the most successful since Naito's last tour with Dontaku. But it's a case of, do you just say, okay, we move on, and then when we want to bring back to a guest spot? And it's a shame. I mean, you're looking at another guy here, a bit like Tanahashi, that's given his entire career to New Japan, given his body effectively to New Japan as well, and felt unappreciated in the end. And you kind of never really want to be in that position, but it's also very hard to say to someone that maybe you're not in the spot now where you can work the main events on a regular basis. Maybe you're not in the spot where you can be the top guy and we need to kind of cycle you sideways or into something else while keeping you around. And not everybody's willing to do that. So I think there were big differences between them at the time. Maybe that changes, maybe it doesn't, but I would like to see him do more. I think the output since has been pretty disappointing.
It is well worth your time to go read the extensive reporting by Trish Spears. The Final Road, it's available at socialsuplex.com. We'll include the link. And, of course, the co-host of the Trish and Sarah Wrestling Podcast that all of you should be checking out. Trish, thanks so much for joining us to chat about this. I thought it was just a fascinating piece of kind of going back of all the behind the scenes that led to this match. Like, you could probably, like, get a book out of this at the end of it, to be quite honest. And maybe you'll lead the way on that.
No, thank you very much for your time and for all the feedback and contributions that you give to us, because it's very much appreciated. So yeah, right. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks a lot, Trish. Yeah. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP-certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science-first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
All right, there you go. Again, the socialsuplex.com is where you can go. Socialsuplex.com to check out the article. We did have another super chat here that I want to get to from Jake from the Windy City. What do you know about the status of Triller TV? I've been seeing some rumblings about the parent company is not doing well and some indies are leaving. So yes, Triller is in the midst of legal issues, to say the least. The MMA Draw has been following this case, and apparently they have they've kind of gone dark. They are owing certain outstanding legal fees, and at the core, Triller TV is losing a ton of money. It sounds like, and I don't know what the future of Triller is going to be, but it is one where certainly if you're following these filings, it's not painting the a profitable picture of Triller.
I have a press release pulled from SEC.gov to read you that I've pulled up when I saw Jake's question here. This is from November 17th, so this is not very new. It's a couple weeks old, but this is about it being delisted from the NASDAQ, I think is what we're reading here. Mm-hmm. Triller announced on November 17th it received an additional delisting determination, which, if you remember a few months back, we were discussing news around Triller, and I think that it owed, I forget what its issues were exactly, but its stock had collapsed and it was at risk of being delisted, I think for lack of reporting its quarterly reports. Anyway, it received an additional delisting determination letter from the listing qualification staff at the NASDAQ Stock Market LLC, indicating that since it failed to timely file its Form Q, which is a Form 10Q, excuse me, which is a quarterly report. This serves as an additional basis for delisting. What does that mean? It won't be in the NASDAQ, and it'll be harder for them to raise money to get cash. Remember, there were some issues around announcing a round of investment that they said they have, but it turned out they didn't have. So we should always emphasize too that this is the entire Triller parent company, which is the parent of the streaming service that we're more familiar with. So I've always kind of thought that, you know, Triller TV kind of makes sense as a business, I think, even though its parent company seems to be in big trouble.
Yeah, the Zach Arnold of Fight Opinion, he had put out yesterday that attorneys on behalf of Triller in their New York lawsuit, where they are the defendants against Yorkville Advisors, have filed papers claiming that Triller has not communicated with counsel in 2 months and allegedly owes $28,000 plus in fees. This is Triller's second batch of attorneys withdrawing in the case. So that's the latest. Not getting back to people. Probably not good.
So I think the outcome here is that you'll see Triller TV maybe be sold as parts, and go to a different parent. Who could that be?
I don't know.
Zone is one that comes to mind for one thing. Who knows? There's always 14th and I out there that are looking to make private equity investments, have some experience in the entertainment business.
Okay. Well, maybe Brad Blum is going to come in and, overtake things. He'll get things back on the straight and narrow. A case involving Conor McGregor has apparently been dismissed. There was a civil suit filed by a Jane Doe. This was a case that we had covered when it was filed at the beginning of the year. The woman claimed she was sexually assaulted by Conor McGregor at a Miami Heat game back in June of 2023. This was the same game, if you recall, that Conor McGregor punched out the mascot, and there was even surveillance footage that did show McGregor going into a bathroom. And of course, what happened in the bathroom is at the core of the dispute. But the woman had alleged unlawful sexual contact at the game and also named the Miami Heat and the operators of the arena, the Kaseya Center, as defendants. And there was a filing for a notice of voluntary dismissal with prejudice.
Those defendants, other than Connor, were dropped earlier this year, I believe at the beginning of this year. So it was only Connor who was the surviving defendant here.
Connor was remaining. And so, yeah, it's a voluntary dismissal. And Brandon, you have followed up. You have like reached out to the attorneys. But it's unknown if they've reached a settlement or what the cause of this filing was.
I did, within the last hour or two, send an email to each of the defendant and plaintiff attorneys asking if there had been a settlement, if there's any comment they want to make. It's important to emphasize that this is a one sentence filing, and it says that the action is voluntarily dismissed with prejudice, meaning that the Jane Doe plaintiff cannot bring this to court again, which almost always means that there's been a settlement, but we cannot confirm that.
All right. And finally, we will go to some ratings notes. And it seems that the ratings are in extensive delay at this point, and that was probably compounded by the holiday last week. But we do have last Monday's figures for Raw. So this was a non-Cena edition of Raw, the November 24th episode, which for the first time fell out of the global top 10 rankings for Netflix. And as Brandon had alluded to at the beginning, this might have been the Stranger Things effect, but regardless, this is the first week since launching that they are outside of the top 10. They did finish in the top 10 in five countries, including the U.S., as well as India, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and Trinidad and Tobago. So, yes, Canada also out of the top 10 landmark.
This is the first time it's not been in the top 10 for Canada?
Yes. Yes.
And it was on the lower end for the U.S. But it doesn't mean that the rating was any lower or higher than usual. As we're demonstrating here with this chart, this is a chart for people watching a video that shows what was the global views number for the number 10 piece of content on Netflix in that top 10 that we get the Raw number from every week. And this is every week going back to the premiere of Raw on Netflix. And for the most part, it's hovered between, you know, 1.5 million and 2.5 million, maybe the highest here is 2.8 million. The number 10 content this week was 4 million, because I guess Stranger Things just came out on, I believe, the 26th. So this apparently prompted everybody to go through and binge previous seasons of Stranger
Things. This is crazy. Like all five seasons of Stranger Things are in the top 10 here, which is just like insane.
At much higher rates than the top 10 usually.
Yeah. Like this is not a case where it's like Raw did, like Raw probably did like a totally normal number. Like 3.1 million was what they did the previous week. And that was like a pretty good number for Raw. So
that was a high number. Yeah.
It's more so just the bar was so high this week that this is probably going to be an anomaly week, because you would not think that all of these other seasons of Stranger Things will keep up, even though the fifth season is probably going to just dominate these charts for the time being.
I mean, maybe this is something that will dissipate. I guess they're doing – I know nothing about Stranger Things other than I think they released part of the season. People in the chat will not correct us. They released part of the season immediately, but it's not all been released yet. So there will be these periodic releases. But this is the beginning of it.
This first set of episodes came out last week. Then another batch come out Christmas Day. And then I believe the finale is New Year's Eve. So we will see recurring Stranger Things bumps on
eventually
on these charts.
We will get these. They do these every 6 months releases of all of their data. Netflix does. So
that's Brandon's Christmas gift every year.
That is. And so I would expect that sometime around after the next quarterly report for Netflix, we'll get a big data dump. So we'll see where this episode ended up with some weeks of trail of watching behind it. But no reason to think that this was. I'm sure it was down from the special Cena Mass at Square Garden episode, but I have no reason to think that it was down lower than that.
Yeah. Also, the Survivor Series this past weekend, it ranked in the top 10 in 14 countries, including Canada, Mexico, the UK, and Saudi Arabia. Survivor Series is always going to be hurt by the fact that it does not stream in the US as well.
I did try. I asked Netflix if they would share the Raw number since we don't have in the top 10. And they politely declined.
They did.
At least I did ask WWE too. But they didn't respond.
Okay. No DM sent to anyone at Netflix or anything like that. No responses.
No one got mad at me in the DMs like they did that one time for something totally different.
We should also mention the fact that they are hyping up the 1 year anniversary of Raw on Netflix with a January 5th episode from the Barclays Center, where they will have CM Punk and Braun Breaker for the WWE Championship. And obviously, I think trying to make that an annual big episode of Raw to follow they're not going to achieve the success of the launch last year, but at least make it like a big pillar episode.
Anniversary of a TV deal commencing. Those are our holidays now in the professional wrestling business.
I mean, we're only a year away from the 1 year anniversary of Impact on AMC. What will they plan for January 2027?
That's true.
Yes. And then finally, the latest numbers we have, Brandon, are last week's Dynamite, which generated 512,000 viewers. This was the episode following Full Gear, which was up 4%, and a 0.10 in the 18 to 49 demo, which was equal to the previous week. Not a whole lot to discern from this other than ratings are coming in at like a snail's pace these days.
Well, the holiday is a big part of that. I have to mention, did you go to Program Insider and try to get the information about this?
I did, and I wanted your I assume you saw the graph from hell that I just nearly gave me an aneurysm trying to figure out.
We can't blame this on our friend Douglas Pucci, who does not have the byline on this report. I don't know if he's on vacation at this time, but just a huge data dump was dropped in here. Very difficult to read. I think I did deduce what the numbers for Dynamite were. I did go and independently confirm that the number that I thought was the number for Dynamite is the number for Dynamite. So we do know that this is 512.
It appears to be sixth for the night on cable. Yeah. With the NBA, whatever this TNT program, what was on at TNT at 9:35 PM for 2.5 hours? Something. Players
Basketball?
Era.
No. Don't know what that is.
Okay. Well,
a ton of data, a lot of demos here. You could print it out for yourself and draw some arrows, and you would have a lot of great demographic data here.
Yes. It's not exactly
men's college basketball, college basketball. Okay. Is what this
okay.
Is.
That makes sense. Okay. MCBB.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it, everybody. You're now up to date on all, the latest, ratings info. My last question, Brandon, what was all the feedback you received last week for your big data plus panel reporting? I think that this got widely circulated. It was extensively reported upon, re-reported upon, and this seemed to cross over. I think it got picked up on Awful Announcing. Did you get
awful
a lot of feedback?
Awful Announcing, I saw. I think there was one other, maybe Yahoo.
Observer did a big breakdown on it.
Did it? Okay.
Yes.
I don't know. Nothing out of the norm, I think, for me. Why would you see something that I don't? Because I don't pay attention to.
No, I'm not trying to be like elusive here. I was just asking you, just general feedback. It was a big story, and it was one that I think a lot of people took attention to, and it probably helped having the CW give a scathing response. Yes. That always helps. And
that always helps.
And I think a lot of people are, it was very impressive that you got all the panel data as well, so everyone can look at. I mean, just any. Any conclusions that you have drawn a week later in terms of how we should be viewing these wrestling numbers? And are you like, is this the sky is falling for pro wrestling, or is this a more measured conclusion you have reached when it comes to they're not labeled as sports? There are potential explanations that you feel might be at play here that could.
The signs to me point to this methodology issue. Mm-hmm. Right? Everything that we're seeing is consistent with that. It's affecting all wrestling programs. Mm-hmm. It's affecting them to a somewhat comparable degree.
You don't think this is like that wrestling was just over-indexing in the previous model? You feel like this is something that it comes down to the way that pro wrestling falls into this unique non-sport category?
That's possible, but it seems more likely that this is a methodology issue, especially in light of that one data point that we have for Collision, where it is less than a 2-hour show. It's only a 67-minute telecast on that occasion. And under big data, it did significantly better than old panel methodology. Mm-hmm. So this is, I think this was an undercover story, and it's going to continue to be. And if you're an analyst on a TKO stock call, this should be a question. What's more important to TKO's business, well, to WWE's business, than media rights fees? You're measuring 20% lower. At least SmackDown is. I don't know if that has bearing on Netflix, but it's measuring 20% lower. What does that mean for you? Does you gonna offer investors any reassurance? I know your stock price is great, but does that mean anything for the next round if this doesn't get corrected? Are you doing anything to get it corrected?
A unified platform, more personalization, more customization.
Why, Mark Spear, are you asking for more customization when it comes to the measurement of some of your most valuable properties? Is that happening? These are questions that should be raised to TKO, to WWE, and to Nielsen, all of whom did not comment on this.
Maybe they're just bogged down. It was Thanksgiving. Maybe you're going to get a slew of emails over the next week. I would be curious because AEW is going to have another 3-hour show in 2 weeks. Be really interesting if we get a comparison
with
the one hour collision tacked on at the end of it, and see if this repeats itself, because
we're not going to know unless somebody can obtain the two methodologies for the same telecast, right? Like, we have examples already in the past of that, right?
Right.
I think there even has been a 1 hour collision after a Dynamite since this. In any case, it's not like it's a 1 hour collision in its normal time slot, so where you can say, oh, it was up.
Yep.
It's 1 hour after Dynamite. It's in a weird time slot as it is. I don't know what to expect there.
Right. I understand. Well, a great job that you did on that. Again, you can check that out at WrestleNomics.com, as you can catch up on all of Brandon's latest reporting and stories and site fees that he is holding these people's feet to the fire. Okay. If you have a public obligation to hand over information, Brandon's coming for you. Okay. Fair
All
warning.
I'm asking is for you to comply with the law. This that's not holding anybody's feet to the fire. That's asking you not to run a red light.
Great point. As Chris Jericho once said, do your job. Do your job. All right. I am going to be back tonight with Wei Ting after a 2-hour edition of Dynamite. Thank God. I don't have 3 hours in me anymore. I'm too old for this. I'm thinking of boycotting SmackDown in the new year. I think I'm done with the show. It's too much for me. And then, coming up on Thursday for members at postwrestlingcafe.com, we're going back to 1991, the Survivor Series. It's a Wednesday night show. It is The Undertaker versus Hulk Hogan. and a very controversial tombstone pile driver that eventually leads to Hogan being under a deposition and having to go through this tombstone spot. Yes. So we do have a deposition courtesy.
Do you need the depositions? I might have them.
Thankfully, David Bixenspan wrote an extensive
piece on this tombstone
spot with the Laser Spine Institute lawsuit from Hulk Hogan, where he had he got called on his previous books, which is never a good sign in your deposition when you're Hulk Hogan and your books are being cited as public comments that you
for entertainment purposes only.
That's it. That was Hulk Hogan writing that book, brother. All right. For more, follow patreon.com/WrestleNomics and follow all things Brandon Thurston related. Anything else to mention, to promote, to give thanks for, Brandon?
Not at this time. You can sign up for a year for a discount at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. We've quietly rolled that out. So
okay.
There's an inside tip.
We're not afraid to pound our chest about it.
On behalf of Mark Shapiro, we will chat with you next Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. A big thanks to Trisha Spears for joining us, and we'll chat next week.